Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's Thursday. It's Open Forum. Two great guests today. This hour, Jimmy Akin here with us. Next hour, Mark Brumley will be here from Ignatius Press. And if you have a question about the Catholic faith, now is your time. This is your chance because Open Forum means any question at all about the Catholic faith is welcome from anybody, whether you're Catholic or not. 888-318-7884 is that number. And the lines fill up very quickly, so you might want to dial soon if you'd like to get in with Jimmy this hour, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of many things, including The Fathers Know Best, Your Essential Guide to the Teachings of the Early Church, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and the forthcoming
Teaching with Authority.
Teaching with Authority, which we're looking for in about, in my mind, six weeks.
About 5 weeks, I think.
About five weeks, something like that.
At least that's what I've been told. Also, I just turned in a new short book, 20 Answers Old Testament, for our 20 Answers series. Turned that in last week. And then just today, I turned in an article on Was Jesus Born on December 25th?
Oh, and that will go where? In the magazine?
In the magazine for the November-December issue.
Oh, yeah. The great Tim Ryland. That's what I call him, the great Tim Ryland, the editor there. And that's cool. So you'll have that coming out in the November-December issue.
Yeah.
And you can get that. If you don't get Catholic Answers magazine, you're missing out on something really great that's happening in the world of Catholic publishing right now. You just go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com and you can get it. So, Jimmy, you said you did the Catholic Answers – excuse me, 20 Answers Old Testament.
Yeah.
And a question came up. Recently, I can't remember if it was on the show or if it was just in a conversation with somebody now. I apologize. But about when did the Jewish people or the people of Israel become strict monotheists?
Wednesday.
Oh, it was Wednesday. Okay. Yeah. What year did they?
So it's going to depend on what you mean by strict monotheist.
Okay.
We have statements early on in the Old Testament that indicate that Abraham came from a pagan family.
Yes.
And that he then became a follower of Yahweh, the true God. But we have a transitional period through the period of the patriarchs where it's not entirely clear whether they understood that only Yahweh exists. The statement is not addressed one way or another. He's described as their God.
Yeah.
But it's not entirely clear that it's clear that monotheism had not become entirely dominant in their family and culture yet. Thus, for example, when Jacob is fleeing from Laban, his wife steals the household teraphim, the household gods, which may be connected with the cult of ancestor worship. Then in Egypt and in the Exodus, we're told that the Israelites prostituted themselves to goat idols and things like that. And then we have in Joshua, when they're going into the land, we have Joshua basically saying, you guys need to make a decision. Are you going to worship the gods that Abraham's ancestors did on the other side of the Euphrates River, or are you going to worship the gods of the Canaanites whose land we've dispossessed, or are you going to worship God who brought you out of Egypt? And they say, oh, we're going to worship the God who brought us out of Egypt, and we really promise. Well, we know that that promise wasn't kept in a lot of circumstances. Even though they were warned repeatedly by the prophets against idolatry, there were a lot of people who worshiped gods in addition to Yahweh. Based on Canaanite practice, that's why we have condemnations of people having Asherim. These were some kind of ritual objects devoted to the goddess Asherah. who was thought to be a relative of the high god El. We also know other people seem to have been worshipers of Baal. We know there were prophets of Baal in the land, like when Elijah had a conflict with them. And really, this continued on until with ups and downs. They were even at various points, the kings allowed pagan sacrifice in Solomon's temple. And then you had good kings who would like clean it all out. But eventually, the paganism problem brought on the Babylonian exile. And that was where you had a real cultural shift. Because when they came back from the Babylonian exile, you didn't have near as much willingness to engage in worshiping foreign gods. And that's really when monotheism, even though it had always been there, that's when the observance of monotheism became really dominant in Jewish society.
So it's a process of learning and coming along and then kind of almost like hitting rock bottom
with the exile.
With the exile and then being like, okay, I'm done with that. We're not going back to that. And that's roughly, what, 450 years before Christ?
It varies on exactly how it's estimated, but like 400 to 500 years,
Okay.
At the end of the exile.
888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lots of folks are on the phone, so I think we'll head right to the phones. Okay, Jimmy?
Okay.
Chase in Harrisonburg, Virginia, watching on YouTube Live. You are up first today. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Si.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my question, and thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
What's your question?
I have a question. It's a family member's question. How can you really justify Catholic or Christian universality, and what is the basis of that universality?
Okay. I need a little bit of clarity. In terms of what your relative means by Christian universality, that can mean a number of different things. Does your relative mean just the claim that everyone should be a Christian, or that Jesus is the way of salvation, or uniquely, or exactly what is the person after?
I think they're including kind of both of those things. So that the fact that that Catholicism should be the one religion for everyone in the world, regardless of multiple different religions, and that it's the one true religion versus all the other religions. And that Jesus,
well,
that would apply to everybody in the world.
So I would say the reason that everybody should be a Christian is because Christianity is true. And that's what the evidence supports. The evidence is provided in a field known as Christian apologetics. It's a field that I practice. Obviously, I can't at the moment give you an entire course in Christian apologetics in the few moments we have on the radio any more than I could say, well, people ought to believe the atomic theory of matter because it's true, and here's a detailed proof of the atomic theory of matter. The basic reason people should believe anything is because it's true, assuming it's true. And then the question beyond that is, well, how do we know if it's true or not? What evidence is there that this is true? And so just like scientists who, you know, have said, okay, matter is made of atoms, just like they have evidence for that you need to study if you want to – don't just want to take their word for it, then the same thing is true of in the sphere of religion. Not to be overly modest, I happen to be an expert in Christian apologetics. It's my job. I've been doing it for more than a quarter century. And I would say there's a lot of evidence. And if you don't want to just take my word for that, fine. We can go into it. I would recommend some things off the top of my head that could be helpful, depending on what your relative is up for. They might want to take a look at a book called The Handbook of Catholic Apologetics by Peter Kraft and Ronald Ticelli. We carry that. Also, C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, is really good. C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, is really good. I have a book called A Daily Defense that that offers a lot of evidence in favor of the Christian faith and the Catholic faith specifically. And so that would be the general outline of my answer. I'd say people should be Christian because Christianity is true. And then it becomes a question of how do we know Christianity is true? What evidence is there for that claim? And I'd point your friend to a source of evidence.
Chase?
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Chase, appreciate the call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Catholics and non-Catholics are welcome. Everybody's welcome. And any question you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church is also welcome. And when Jimmy's here, we just try to broaden it out. If you have a general question of a general religious nature or a philosophical or moral question, those questions are welcome too. 888-318-7884, the number. We're joined now in studio by Erica Sanchez. Erica, oh my gosh, I did it again.
That wasn't even my name. Before I got married.
I know. Because of Emily that I do that. I apologize.
No, can I tell you though, like, even before working here,
it just came out.
Everybody called me Erica Sanchez.
Sorry, I don't know.
And that's never been my name.
Well, because it sounds almost like Olson. Like they're
just
almost the
slightly.
Same. Yeah,
yeah.
Erica Olson sounds like Erica Sanchez. I apologize. Tell us give us some numbers about the conference coming up.
Oh my gosh,
can I tell you,
I'm like, it's like finally hitting me that it's just like 3 weeks away. I'm so excited and like nervous at the same time. I'm like running around like a chicken with her head cut off. I'm so nervous.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be amazing. It totally is. It's like it always ends up like going off so great. But as the planner, you get like so scared and nervous. But we are nearing sold out, which has never happened in the history of this conference. So I'm thrilled about that. We're down to our last like 127 or so tickets.
Yeah.
Of those 127 tickets, only 60 of them are available at the full conference ticket. So the full conference ticket includes the banquet dinner with Cardinal Burke's keynote address.
Yeah.
Only 60 of those remain. So that's never in the history of this has that ever happened. I'm like just nervous talking about it because our attendance is through the roof and I'm so excited. So come out and join us because there's going to be a ton of Catholics there that you're going to get to mix and mingle and meet with.
Square dance with. Square
dance
with.
There's a poolside reception for you guys to just get to know each other. There's going to be a live taping of this show, which is just so fun.
Twice.
You're going to get to see the show in action on Thursday as you register. You can take pictures of Cy and his guests. And
Maybe
he'll call on you for a question or two, right, as people walk by. Then we're going to have the live show, the big live show on Friday with the questions from the studio audience. And
it's a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
The theme of the conference is faith and science, friends or foes, one of the most important issues of our time, frankly. And in many ways, because so many people answer the question with the word foes, it has driven many, many people away from the faith. We'd like to combat that and give you the tools to combat it. Just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com and sign up today. CatholicAnswersConference.com, only 60 full ticket with dinner with Cardinal Burke available.
Yes.
Am I correct in that?
That's correct.
All right. And the way that it works on Thursday, we're going to do open forum and we'll have a tip jar there. And depending on the size of the tip, that will determine whether we take
a question. You take a question. That's a good call. I like it.
I think we may revisit that policy before.
I hadn't run that by Jimmy, by the way. I hadn't run that by him. CatholicAnswersConference.com.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
When you engage with the wisdom of saints this way, it stokes the fires of God in our hearts, encourages us, strengthens us, and gives us wisdom to deal with the difficulties of life. It also gives us wisdom that allows us to rise above all of the junk, to live with joy and peace in the midst of even the most difficult circumstances.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour, and the lines are very busy, so I'm just going to keep moving. Nate in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. You are up next, Nate. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, sir. Hi, Jimmy. I'm sorry. There's a rainstorm. I apologize if my connection cuts out a little bit.
Oh, okay.
I'm calling to ask about the recent change to the catechism. Mm-hmm. I have pulled up the EWTN webpage /expert/answers, capital punishment, and it says the Pope concludes today, in fact, as a consequence of the possibilities which the state has for effectively preventing crime by rendering one who has committed an offense incapable of doing harm without definitively taking away from his possibility of redeeming himself, the cases in which execution of the offender is an absolute necessity are very rare, if not practically non-existent. So my question is, when did that happen? Because I would understand that we have had that option for centuries, that we've had prisons, we've had dungeons, we have had ways for people to be imprisoned indefinitely away from and protecting society
right.
for mm-hmm. thousands of years or hundreds
right.
of years. So
right,
why now is this a change?
Okay, why now, Jimmy?
I think it's a combination of things. One of them, it sounds like the text that you just read actually reflects the situation before the recent catechism change, which reflects the previous catechism change that had happened in the 1990s on this question. The idea that we've had detention facilities of some sort for thousands of years is true. I mean, there were prisons in the ancient world or dungeons, but they did not exist on the scale they do now. So you could not put nearly as many people behind bars indefinitely the way you can today. And that's one of the reasons that in the past, imprisonment was not nearly as widely used for different offenses against society. They tended to go one of two ways, either impose a temporary thing like maybe flogging or caning or, you know, some kind of physical corporal punishment or an economic punishment. They'd fine you. And so it's both of those are kind of one-time things and then it's over. Or if because they didn't have a lot of space to detain people indefinitely, they would simply use the death penalty. And so even though detention systems have existed throughout, you know, human history, at least since the Neolithic age, there just weren't enough of them to use imprisonment on a widespread basis. And so punishments tended to go either into the temporary bodily or economic punishment or execution, or in some situations, banishment was another option. Now, obviously, in the case of someone who's, say, a murderer, merely an economic fine is not enough. Merely a caning is not enough. Exiling a person just transfers the problem elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't have enough prison facilities to be able to house those people, execution is the logical choice. So there really has been a cultural shift in terms of this based on the number of prisons that exist today that didn't exist in the past. If you go back, you know, just a couple hundred years or 200 or 300 years in British history, you'll find that the death penalty was prescribed for all kinds of crimes, including things like pickpocketing, that it's not prescribed for today. And one of the reasons for that was they didn't have an extensive prison system. They may have had dungeons and castles here and there, but they didn't yet have a big prison system. And so So the death penalty was prescribed for a lot of things. That's even part of what Gilbert and Sullivan are making fun of in their operetta, The Mikado, which even though it's set in Japan, it's poking fun at British culture. And in The Mikado, you have beheading prescribed for all kinds of things, even just flirting.
Well, that seems correct, actually.
Yeah, well, so there has been a shift in our culture in this regard. In addition, there's been – I mentioned more than one factor. There's also been a growing movement in society that disfavors the use of the death penalty. And, you know, the church is a creature of its times. The attitudes that are common in society tend to be reflected in one degree or another in the church. And so as opposition to the death penalty has grown in different areas of society, various churchmen have become more opposed to the death penalty, and that's playing a role in why the catechism has been changed recently. Another thing that I think is worth pointing out, though it's really a subsidiary factor here, is that just because you have prisons doesn't mean they're remotely humane. In the ancient world, being stuck in a dungeon, while it might keep you away from people, did not make that a humane form of detention. And I mean, heck, you could be hauled out of your cell and tortured for fun for, you know, in a bunch of circumstances, presumably. The health conditions were bad. The food conditions were bad. The confinement conditions were bad. And so an additional change that has happened to some degree in the modern penal system is prisons have gotten more humane in recent years, which makes long-term detention an even more attractive option to many people than long-term detention would have been in the past when conditions were less humane. Now, having said that, a lot of prisons are still inhumane, and that's true, especially true in the developing world, but it's even true here in the developed world. So so that's why I say that's a lesser factor. But the improvement in prison conditions, as well as the expansion of prisons in raw, in quantitative numbers, have both played a role in making that a more attractive option than simply execution.
Okay, Nate.
Thank you. May I just ask one extra question?
Real quick.
It's on the same topic. So the reasons you gave all make sense. It just seems like it portrays the church as a follower of culture instead of an influencer in culture or morals. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's a question for another time, but it doesn't seem like they could have set this precedent earlier and influenced the different.
Yeah,
that's all.
It's an intermix. We were discussing earlier today, I forget if it was in our pre-show or during this hour, but we were discussing earlier today how it took the Israelites a certain period of time to get weaned off of polytheism before they embraced monotheism in a full, robust way. And the same thing is true of Christians after the time of Christ. Culture plays a role in these things. The consciousness of the church progresses over time as the Holy Spirit leads the church into all truth. That progress sometimes involves secular factors outside of the church. Sometimes it involves developments within the church. But what we can have confidence in is that the Holy Spirit is ultimately leading the church.
Thanks, Nate. We move now to Ryan in Midland, Texas, also listening on Guadalupe Radio. Ryan, your question for Jimmy Akin.
All right, Jimmy, I have a two-part question, but can you answer the first one before I get to the second one?
Okay.
They're both short.
Good, because we're right up to against the hard break. What are your questions?
Okay, the first part is whether or not the Latin Church acknowledges this as fact, but given St. Peter had a bishopric in Antioch before going to Rome, where I presume he celebrated Antiochian liturgy.
Why are there no successors of Peter in Antioch? Okay, what's the second question?
Okay, given Luke is not mentioned anywhere in the New Testament in as being one of Jesus' apostles or disciples, why is he also not listed as being an early church father?
Okay, so the answer to the second question is that Luke is one of the authors of the New Testament. And the authors of the New Testament are not grouped as church fathers. The church fathers, although some of them lived in the first century, like Clement of Rome, they are all people who are not known to be authors of the New Testament. If you're a known author of the New Testament, you're put in a different category because you're living you're just put in a different category. In terms of the second question, Peter did not die in Antioch, and so consequently he did not leave his successor in Antioch in any primary sense. And so even though Antioch looks to Peter as part of its heritage, it doesn't have the successor of Peter in the unique way that the Church of Rome does, which is where Peter died.
Ryan, you did it. You got him out quickly. Thank you very, very much. 888-318-7884 is our number. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. It does, with both Peter and Paul going to Rome, mm-hmm. both dying in Rome, and yep. then Rome also being the capital of the empire.
All of those played a role in its prominence, but the fact Peter died there is the key to why his successor is there.
Fair enough. Again, I want to let you know remind you that we have that free MP3 from Jimmy Akin, Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book. It's a great talk that Jimmy gave. We want you to have it. You just go to our Facebook page. Oh, no, you can go to Catholic.com, just our regular homepage, Catholic.com, and look for the Understanding Revelation banner. Click it, and you get that free MP3. Again, open forum here on Catholic Answers Live. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Back with more after this.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Catholic Answers is a media ministry that serves Christ by explaining and defending the Catholic faith. We help Catholics grow in their faith, we bring former Catholics home, and we lead non-Catholics into the fullness of the truth. Our goal is to be the most trusted and accessible source for sharing, explaining, and defending the Catholic faith through as many media as possible, from personal contact to the most innovative means of mass communication. Have questions? We've got answers. Catholic Answers. Visit us today at Catholic.com or call us with your questions at 619-387-7200.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture's moral center continues to fly apart, and with every form of deviance publicly aired and celebrated, we have no choice but to equip our kids to understand about such issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. Silence can no longer be an option. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging on to the shop at Catholic.com.
How have you found a blessing in your disability?
Maybe you've become a stronger person through your own struggles.
Share with us on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now let's get back to Cy Kellett and more of Catholic Answers Live.
Thanks, Jerry and Debbie, for sending it back to us here at Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour, and lots of questions already in the queue. If you'd like to get in the queue to ask a question, 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Next hour, Mark Brumley will be here from Ignatius Press, so there, you are in good hands whether your call gets through this hour or next. Rosemary in Louisville, Kentucky, listening on the EWTN app, is up next. Rosemary, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, my grandson will be 13 soon, and he's baptized but has never been brought up in the faith.
Mm-hmm.
I moved recently to be closer to him and ordered the Revised Standard Bible from Catholic Answers to give him.
Mm-hmm.
What books do I suggest he begin reading in the Bible? By the way, his first name is Matthew. Should he begin reading Matthew?
Matthew would be a good option if that's sure. If his name is Matthew, Matthew's a good option. Before I knew that, I was going to suggest Luke and Acts, because Luke and Acts form a connected story, and stories are something that everybody loves and has an easy time processing. And together they give you a good picture both of the ministry of Jesus and of the early church. And so I would recommend, you know, one of the Gospels. Matthew would be a good one. Luke would also be a good one. And then the book of Acts.
Okay. Okay. And then just continue in the, throughout the New Testament before going to the Old Testament?
Generally, yeah. I would recommend that.
Okay.
Now,
okay,
you know, well, whether what exactly he's going to be interested in and whether he'll take, you know, to this Bible reading at his age is something that I don't know. My grandmother gave me a Bible when I was 13, and I didn't read it till I was an adult. An additional option that you might want to explore with him is reading a catechism to provide an overview of the faith in addition to what he can learn from Scripture.
Okay. Okay. That would probably be the UCAT, right?
That would be a good example, sure.
Okay. Thank you so much. I
no
appreciate
problem. Thank
time.
You, Rosemary. Appreciate yeah. that call. 888-31-TRUTH, the number here. We go now to Faith in New Hampshire. Let me get the button. Faith, you have a question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes.
Your question, please,
if
Faith.
God is... What?
Oh, go ahead, hon. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay. If God is in eternity and doesn't experience time, how could have there been a before and an after in the creation of the universe?
Okay. From God's perspective, there wasn't a before or after in the creation of the universe. God, since he's outside of time, has the beginning of the universe present right in front of him and every subsequent moment in the universe present right in front of him. So from his perspective, there was nothing before the creation of the universe, because the creation of the universe is still right there in front of him, just like every other moment in history. Before and after is something that exists only inside of time or only inside of history. It's kind of like, if this helps, it's kind of like if you have an aquarium. The aquarium may be filled up with water, but the room that the aquarium is in doesn't have any water. It's not full of water. And in the same way, where God is in eternity is not filled up with time. There is no before and after there. But it within the universe, it is filled up with time. And so there is a before and after inside the universe.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, isn't it?
Thank you. Faith, do you mind telling us how old you are?
Yeah, I'm 9 years old, and I've been reading The Truth Is Out There, and that gave me the question.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's an excellent comic book to learn your faith by. Keep reading it.
Yes.
Also, as being 9 years old, you've got a great future in temporal mechanics ahead.
Thank you.
Okay.
Faith, will you wait a minute? And Marie, our call screener, will talk to you, because Marie just went out and got – well, actually, I think it was Carrie that got new kids' books. Maybe we could send her one. I know you Marie says, yeah, we can send you one, Faith. If it's okay with your mom, give your address to Marie, and we'll send you one of the new kids' books we just got in.
Or have your mom give the address.
Oh, yeah. That's another – right. That's an excellent idea. 888-318-7884. The number we go now to Verlin, listening on the Catholic Answers app in Alabama. Verlin, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. I was curious if when Jesus actually became the high priest. I was in a conversation with a Protestant friend, and he used Hebrews 8:4 to say that Jesus could not become the high priest until after he ascended to heaven.
Hmm.
And I always assumed Jesus was the high priest while he was still here on earth.
Okay, so we want to clarify that when we when we're talking about Jesus's high priesthood, we mean in the Christian sense, not in the Jewish sense, because he was never the Jewish high priest. Hebrews 8:4, depending on the translation you're reading, will say things like, "For if he were on earth," talking about Jesus, "he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law." And I don't think that verse proves your friend's point for a couple of reasons. One is, what's the frame of reference he's talking about? He's talking about the earthly Jewish frame of reference. So in that frame of reference, Jesus wouldn't have been a priest, because he wouldn't have been a Levitical priest, because he wasn't of the tribe of Levi, which is one of the things the author of Hebrews is discussing. So if he were merely an earthly priest, he wouldn't have been a priest, because they're already in a Jewish context, because there already were Jewish priests who were all from the tribe of Levi, and Jesus didn't qualify for that. And the point the author of Hebrews is making is that Jesus's ministry is much greater and encompasses heaven, and he thus has a heavenly application of his ministry, and so he does qualify as a priest in this greater sense. That leads to the second point that I would make as to why I don't think this verse proves what your friend wants it to, which is the fact that the Bible indicates Jesus gave himself on the cross as a sacrifice for us, and only priests are authorized to offer sacrifices. So that means that even though it's not connected with the earthly Levitical priesthood, Jesus did begin to exercise his heavenly priesthood even here on earth when he offered himself on the cross as a sacrifice. this is something that actually a lot of folks in the Protestant community would agree with. They would acknowledge, you know, the cross is an altar. Jesus offered himself as the victim on the cross. Since he offered himself, he was the offering priest. And so they would recognize Jesus's priestly ministry as extending into his earthly mission and not just being something he assumed in his heavenly ministry.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Thank you, Vernon. Let's go to Daniel in Dallas, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Daniel, thanks for downloading the Catholic Answers app onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. My question is pertaining to something I heard at a Bible study some time ago. The claim being made was that you would no longer be married to your spouse after death.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they were using Matthew 22, verse 30 to justify that. So I was wondering if you could give some context on that and clarify what that means.
Yeah. So in the Gospels, particularly in Mark and Matthew, Jesus, in discussing the this comes up a couple of in several places, but in the passion narratives leading in the final week in Jerusalem before he suffers, Jesus in the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, comes into conflict with a group called the Sadducees. And the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. They thought that when you die, you're just worm food. You cease to exist. They're very unusual in that belief, because almost no group in human history has had that as one of their convictions, especially a religious group. But the Sadducees did. And so they propose a trick question for Jesus. They want to trap him by saying, okay, suppose you have a brother who dies. He's married a woman, but before they can have a child, he dies. And so under the Jewish law, his brother must marry the woman to raise up a child for the dead brother. But then suppose he dies too, and suppose that keeps happening through like 10 brothers. Well, okay, if the resurrection is true, Mr. High and Mighty Jesus, then when they all come back to life, whose wife is she going to be, because she was married to all of them? And Judaism does not countenance polyandry. So Judaism doesn't approve of wives having more than one husband. So who's it going to be? And they think they've posed a paradox for Jesus that he's not going to be able to get out of. But in fact, he does get out of it. He points out in the resurrection of the dead, men are going to be like angels, neither marrying nor giving in marriage. So we're not going to be married in the afterlife. That's something that's reflected in other passages of the New Testament, such as Romans 7, where Paul talks about how if a woman dies, if a woman's husband dies, then she's freed from the law of marriage regarding her husband, and she can marry another man without committing adultery. But she can't do that if he's still alive. And so this awareness that we're not going to be married in the afterlife is something, and that death dissolves marriage, is something that is found in more than one place in the New Testament. Having said that, it doesn't mean that we're not going to know our spouses or love our spouses or anything like that. I myself am a widower, and I fully expect that in the next life, I'll meet my wife and we'll love each other even more than we did in this life, because in the next life we'll be perfect and filled with God's love, and it'll be even greater than the love we had in this life. It just won't be marital love.
Daniel?
Yes, that helps.
Okay.
And I just want to say thanks to you guys. We've been listening to you for a couple of years, me and my fiance.
Oh, awesome.
Y'all have been a big part in our conversion to the Catholic faith. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Yeah. That's really generous of you to share that. Thank you.
Many happy years to you and your fiance.
I think he, you know what? He probably still wants to be married to her after death. That's why he's getting ready to be married to her now.
This is something that everybody has a sense of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book. That is, as I'm saying, a great talk by Jimmy Akin on one of the most talked about books of the Bible. You can download your copy by visiting the Catholic.com homepage. Look for the Understanding Revelation banner right up there at the top and just click away and download. We want to give it to you free. Understanding Revelation, Decoding the Bible's Most Mysterious Book. Free MP3 download at Catholic.com.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I said to the sisters one day, what do you think you're going to look like in heaven? Oh, some of them had absolutely magnificent ideas. I didn't think of one of them. And so I got desperate because then my turn came. I didn't know what to say. And so in desperation, I said, what do you think I'll wear in heaven? And they all said with one voice, armor!
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum, Jimmy Akin here in studio with us this hour. And open forum means anybody can call with any question they got about the Catholic faith. Patricia in Columbus, Ohio, listening on 820 AM. You are up next. Patricia, your question for Jimmy.
Sure. I have just a quick question. I am an ex-Protestant convert to Eastern Orthodoxy because I grew up in a very anti-Catholic culture. Mm-hmm. So I'm just beginning to learn about the Catholic faith, and I've been listening to you guys quite a bit and reading some books. And I talked to a priest who told me, well, I don't really need to convert. Being Eastern Orthodox is fine. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a little confused.
Well,
what does the Catholic Church actually teach in this kind of situation?
Yeah, I understand the priest is trying to be nice, and it's true that there are tremendous amounts of truth and grace that are found in the Eastern Orthodox Church, but from a Catholic perspective, there are graces and truths that are available in the Catholic Church in a unique way that aren't available elsewhere. One of them is full communion with the successor of St. Peter, which is something Jesus willed his church to have because he said to Peter, I will build my church you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So Jesus has established a church built on Peter with a special Petrine office or Petrine charism that has never had the gates of hell prevail against it. So it's existed from the first century down to today. And that church is the Catholic Church. So Jesus wants people to have the fullness of the truth and the grace that he's made available to them. And that fullness of truth and grace is found in a unique way in the Catholic Church. So even though there are many elements of truth and grace in other Christian communities, and especially in Eastern Christian communities, including Orthodox communities, nevertheless, Jesus wants you to have more. He wants you to have the fullness of what he made available in his church. And so I would say the priest was trying to be nice, but didn't fully accurately represent the Catholic position to you on that question.
Okay. That helps.
All right. Well, I think we're losing you there just a little bit, Patricia, but thank you so much for your call.
And keep listening and let us know whenever we can be of assistance in answering any questions.
Margie in Detroit, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. You are up next. Margie, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. My question is about the recent change to the catechism about the death penalty.
Uh-huh.
And my question is, how did that come about? And that's part A. Part B, was it legitimate? Because it seemed like it was just like a unilateral decision by the Pope. And if it was, what would have stopped a Pope from like changing the catechism to say a sin is not a sin?
Okay.
How did that – I just want to have more information about that.
Okay. Well, this is something that has been brewing for a while. Recent popes have been taking a progressively more negative attitude towards capital punishment. And it's not just recent popes. It's recent bishops all over the world. If you look at the trajectory on this subject, the clear trajectory in among bishops around the world has been towards a more skeptical attitude towards the death penalty rather than towards a more open attitude towards the death penalty. So this isn't just the Pope. Having said that, the Pope does have the authority to change particular passages in the Catechism. He's the one who promulgated the Catechism. I mean, John Paul II was the one who did it first, and subsequently he revised it, and now Pope Benedict has revised Pope Francis has revised it. And popes can alter the wording of the catechism just like they can alter the wording of the code of canon law, because they're the promulgators of the catechism the same way they're the promulgators of the code of canon law. In terms of what stops the pope from saying adultery isn't a sin or something like that, well, a number of things. One is, and you can look at this from more than one perspective, even if a pope did say such a thing, he would simply be mistaken, because it's already infallible church teaching that adultery is a sin. And if he tried to change the catechism to where it said adultery is not a sin, that would mean he would be in a fallible way issuing a mistaken statement. But it wouldn't affect the church's infallible teaching, which the Pope does not have the ability to deny. It would just mean he's making a mistake. Would such a mistake be likely? Well, no, the Holy Spirit is guiding the Pope and the other bishops, and through the action of the Holy Spirit, there's going to be, if a Pope were to attempt such a change and just say adultery is no longer a sin, everybody, there would be a mighty convulsion about that, and other bishops would step up and say, Your Holiness, we really can't say this. This is infallibly settled church teaching. And so ultimately, because the Holy Spirit guides the church, even if the Pope tried to do something like that, in the end, truth will ultimately prevail because the Holy Spirit progressively guides the church into truth, and so temporary mistakes that get made ultimately won't stand.
Margie, I hope that is helpful. I'm going to kind of keep moving just because I got to get to as many questions as I can this hour. Aaron in Florida watching on YouTube, you're up next. Aaron, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. I had two quick questions regarding holy orders. Mm-hmm. The first question was, I know that Leo XIII declared Anglican holy orders as invalid due to the changing of the essential form. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know, how is it that the post-Vatican II holy orders can still be considered valid? And then the second question would be, why is it that the pre-Vatican II holy orders are not allowed to be performed anymore, while the other pre-Vatican II sacraments are still being performed?
As far as I'm aware, in various, and I could be mistaken on this, but as far as I'm aware, pre-Vatican II rites of ordination are in use licitly in some communities, that the Holy See has allowed that. I am not 100% sure on that, but that's my understanding. In terms of why they're not valid, well, why they weren't invalidated the way Anglican orders were, well, because the intention and the essential form were not changed in the same way, and so it didn't invalidate. So I hope that helps.
Okay. Thank you, Jimmy.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I didn't know if you had another question to follow up. Thanks, Aaron. Thanks very much. Angel in New Mexico, listening on the iCatholic Radio app. You are up next. Angel, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Nice to be on the line with you.
Thank you. What's your question?
So my question is, I went in to see a therapist today, and she wants to approach a hypnosis method to treat PTSD.
Okay.
And it was brought to my attention by a fellow Catholic friend that Catholic teaching is against hypnosis.
Okay.
So I'm kind of on the fence if I should try this, if it really is against our teachings.
Your friend is mistaken.
So I just wanted some insight on that.
Your friend is mistaken. There is no Catholic teaching on the subject of hypnosis. Catholics can have a diversity of opinions on it and what it is and how it works. If it has therapeutic value in treating a particular condition like post-traumatic stress disorder, and nothing in the particular session contradicts Catholic teaching, then there's no problem from that perspective in using hypnosis any more than there is using any other therapeutic technique.
Okay. Okay.
So
awesome.
if it works for you, great. If it doesn't, then hopefully you'll be able to find another form of treatment that does help.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Thank you very much, Angel. We go now to Alberto in Chesapeake, Virginia, listening on CatholicAnswersLive.com. Alberto, your question for Jimmy.
Would it have been possible for Mary and for Paul the Apostle, our Blessed Mother Mary and Paul the Apostle, to have met sometime in their lives?
Sure. So based on the best chronology, in my opinion, that we have, the crucifixion occurred in April of AD 33. The next month, we have Pentecost occurring. We have Mary being mentioned as being in Jerusalem with the other disciples at that time. So that's AD 33. Paul, according to our best chronology, was likely converted in AD 36. Just 3 years later. And within a few years, by AD 38 or 39, he had come to Jerusalem to visit it. So that means that he and Mary had come into had both visited the same city within about 5 years of each other. Now, that doesn't prove that they were in the same city at the same time. Mary could have gone back to the family home in Nazareth. We don't know. She could have gone elsewhere. It's quite possible based on those dates, it looks like their lifespans overlapped for a considerable period. They traveled in similar circles, namely Jewish Christian ones in the Holy Land. And so while I can't prove that they met, it's certainly within the realm of possibility.
Okay, Alberto.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. Those are always interesting questions to me. The timeline questions are fascinating.
Yeah.
But timelines are hard because you have to make certain assumptions and
sometimes your planet blows up and all that.
In what timeline does the planet blow up?
The Kelvin timeline. You mentioned it yourself. Vulcan blew up.
Oh, that's right. That was in the pre-show. We talked about the fact that the planet Vulcan was destroyed by mining equipment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But they, you don't even accept that timeline, Jimmy.
No, it's not my favorite timeline.
But your planet can blow up. That does happen to the best of people.
Especially if it gets hit by another planet. That, you know, they say that kind of happened to Earth.
Yeah, like a little planet hit Earth, and then there was a big mess, and that formed the moon and the Earth.
And the modern Earth.
So some of what is up there on the moon now used to be down here on Earth.
According to that theory, yep.
Do you think it's a likely theory, or do you have
no reason to challenge it? I know there are different theories about the origin of the moon, but that's the most widely accepted one today, is my understanding.
There's some parts of the Earth I would like to see go to the moon now, if we could arrange that.
Okay.
But
I wouldn't mind taking a trip there myself.
Oh, you'd handle it way better than I would be so dizzy if I got in any one of those rocket ships. Jimmy Akin, thank you so much for another fine hour.
Thank you.
And don't forget, Jimmy's got a brand new podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And here's a little info for you. Tomorrow, we're going to take kids' calls. We're going to do an entire hour of kids' open forum. And the guest will be?
Me.
Jimmy Akin.
Yeah.
So we had an early kids' call today, but that was just warm-up for you. Taking it over tomorrow. Next hour, Mark Brumley, more open forum after this.